Good afternoon and welcome to Open Air with Sherry Huber. I'm your host, Michael Gray. Welcome, Sherry.
Thank you, sir.
Tonight we're here in Toyon Hall with a live audience on the Stanford University campus. Wow.
Not only are they attractive, they're loud.
They're loud and lively and
fun.
Enthusiastic.
I'm excited.
Sherry Huber has been a Zen student and teacher for 30 years. She's the author of many, many books. And we're going to be talking tonight about a whole range of wonderful topics.
Actually, anything that these nice folks want to talk about.
That's correct. That's where you guys come in. And we have two microphones set up about halfway back, one on the left side and one on the right side, at varying heights. So depending on your height, you can choose the microphone that feels most appropriate to you. And so our conversation today is open to any topic.
Yes, yes. I'm fond of pointing out to people that I'm willing to talk about anything of a spiritual nature. And since in my world everything is spiritual, then it's pretty wide open.
Pretty wide open. Spiritual is everything.
Everything is spiritual.
Huh. Everything is spiritual.
Mm-hmm. So in Zen, you know, we have the, I don't think we can call it a notion. I always try to strike the balance between sounding like a know-it-all and sounding wishy-washy. So it's not, you know, if I say we have the notion that body and mind are one, it sounds like somebody just thought of that and maybe it is and maybe it isn't. And actually, the way the Buddha taught us, it is. And it's our job as students of awareness to prove that to ourselves.
Yes.
So body and mind are one. Spiritual, material, one. Same thing. One is tangible, one is not. One we can see and one we can't. Hmm. But they're one.
Uh-huh.
So, yeah, it's wide open.
Wide open. Great.
And, of course, if we tie that in with the whole thrust of Zen practice, as I know it, being that we have the opportunity in this lifetime to end suffering.
Uh-huh.
And the best way to end suffering is to find out how we suffer. Because when we know, when we understand how we suffer, then we can not do that and we can end suffering. So again, what would we leave outside that? You know, the topics that most often people want to leave outside awareness practice are the very things that should be included.
Uh-huh.
Right? Because the subjects that we're taught to leave outside are the ones that we suffer most over.
Yes.
Hardly anybody suffers over gardening. You know, or I mean, maybe people do, but you know, but something like sexuality or money or religion or politics, you know, lots of suffering.
Uh-huh.
So we have all these kind of rules in society that we don't talk about those things. And so what does that do? It keeps them hidden away, keeps us in a world of suffering.
Yes, and it seems like that's one of the huge benefits of having a show like this, where we can talk about stuff that we often feel is not appropriate to talk about.
And now here we can look them in the eye.
Absolutely.
Right. So we know who said what. Now the audience at home doesn't know who said what, but we do. Let's face it, and
Absolutely.
They know, right? They can look around and see who said that. But when we're actually, you know, on the air in the studio, it's great because it is absolutely anonymous. If
yes.
people, now we don't usually let people know this, but we often just change people's names because we don't want their even the people who know them, unless they recognize their voice, to know that that person is talking about that thing, because we have so much information that says you can't talk about that. It's not okay to talk about that. You're going to be revealing yourself. You're going to be making yourself too vulnerable. You have to hide out and pretend that's not going on and look good and all this stuff. So
yeah.
Yeah, in Zen practice, we make a a concerted effort to create what we call a privileged environment in which people can look at anything and feel safe in doing that. People aren't going to comment on them. People aren't going to refer to it later. So we can bring all this stuff out, yeah. Get free of it.
And to me, that's a big power of it, is getting it out there and talking about it. And then there's a real sense that, you know, everybody has the same stuff.
Yeah.
Oh. Slightly different variations.
Oh, God. The only way that we can perpetuate this myth that we're different or unique is by not talking. Yeah. It's funny, that's a double-edged sword, because on the one hand, there are people who want to be reassured, I am not as strange as the voices in my head tell me I am. And then on the other hand, but I thought I was unique. You mean, uh-huh. I'm just like everyone else?
Uh-huh.
And the good and the bad news is, yes.
Uh-huh. So how do we resolve that dichotomy?
Well, to me, the way we resolve all... that was a good moment, wasn't it? To me, Michael. And just then, the flash goes off. To me, the way we solve that and all dualities is through awareness, through seeing what's going on. So in a case like that, you know, there are duality, all right? So there's a part of me who thinks that I'm weird and odd, and then there's a part of me who wants to be unique. So if those two parts of me remain unexamined, then I'm just bouncing back and forth between the two. And we can pick any subject, and we have that kind of duality going. And that duality is the thing that keeps our identity in place. So mm-hmm. There's a part of me that just wants to spend money like crazy, and a part of me who is completely tight. Part of me just wants to eat everything in sight, and another part of me would like me to starve to death. And my personality, my identity, it exists in between the crunch of those dualities.
Yes.
So as I bring awareness to it, and the trickiest part, of course, of bringing awareness is I need to bring awareness without judgment to get anywhere. And we are so heavily conditioned to see everything about ourselves in a framework of judgment, that the judgment is what holds it in place. So that's kind of job one. You know, first I see what judgment is and how it works and how it keeps me stuck and how I'm never going to win in that arena. And until I go beyond judgment, I'm just going to be trapped there in suffering. So I break that one down through paying attention and watching how things work. And then I begin to move into the other duality. So there's the part who wants to be unique and the part who wants to fit in. Now, then I get to know each of those parts. I understand them. I see what their conditioning is. I don't believe either one of them is more valid or worthwhile or particularly helpful than the other. In fact, what I'm learning to do in seeing them in that way is to step back and be able to see something beyond the world of duality,
mm-hmm.
a place of clarity in which it just is. You know, I don't have to decide between those two houses which one is beautiful and which one is ugly. That is actually not a requirement in life. I don't have to love certain foods and hate certain foods. I don't. Now, as I'm growing up, that's how my identity is formed. I'm a person who likes this and doesn't like this. I have really strong feelings about this. This is really important to me. I need it to be this way. I'm only happy, you know, so we get a lot of investment in that. When we begin to realize that that's the source of our suffering, then we start finding a greater willingness to say, really, who cares? You know, those people live in that house and they're happy. Those people live in that house and they're happy. Good. Then it's up to me to find the house I want to live in, and it's up to me to be happy in that house,
yes.
Which is the hardest part.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, because
once you move in, you realize that you actually wanted the other house.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's how duality works.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you can never be satisfied.
That's right. And we begin to see that what's holding the kind of the bottom line of the what's holding it all together is what the Buddha talked about as suffering, and probably a clearer image of that or a clearer word in English for that is dissatisfaction. So no matter what I'm doing, no matter where I am, no matter what's happening, there's this We talk about it as a persistent voice of discontent. Mm-hmm. You know, it could be better. It could be different. Why is it that? Why don't I? I don't think. It just drones on, taking the fun out of life.
Yes. And it seems to me a big piece of what you're talking about is getting rid of that judgment so that it's okay to look at what's going on in here.
Yeah.
So there are parts of me that I don't like.
Yeah. And of course, that's an interesting one because there are parts of me. Who doesn't like them?
Right.
Well, another part of me.
Yeah.
So we break down that whole judging cycle and just kind of take it apart and see what it is and where it came from and how it happened. And as we do that, then we realize that I was carefully taught to think that's important and that's valuable and those people are special. And, you know, if I were in another culture at another time, I would have been taught something completely different. So it doesn't mean anything, and it certainly doesn't mean anything that I need to give my life for.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. It reminds me, as you're talking, as we practice, we become more aware of all of this continuous internal conversation just going on and on. It wants to be sort of below the surface without any, you know, careful looking at.
Yeah, below the surface. That's where it lives. And it just, we're meant to hear it and react to it, have it create our reality, but never actually hear it, never see it for what it is.
Yes.
Yeah, so it just controls our life experience. And if we happen to hear it or see it, we're taught to say, well, that's just me. You know, well, that's just how I feel. That's what I think.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting starting to look at that process and just seeing all of this stuff that's going on inside of me that I'm not even aware of. And you used an image once that I found really powerful, which was a hand on the small of my back sort of steering me through life.
Yes.
Making certain decisions.
Yes. That's what you can count on. And of course, what interferes with that is this just endless yammy, 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 yammy of, you've got to do this, you should do this, and it's got to be this way, and if you don't do that, and then something is going to happen, and oh my God, what's going to...
Yeah. Yes. Yes.
Oh, look at that.
Wow. I think she's standing at the microphone there.
She is.
Sherry, my memory is that you once said something like, everything is an opportunity to be with, and I wondered if you could say more about that and how to do that.
Uh-huh. So the first piece of it is, what does that mean, everything is an opportunity to be with? Is that true? So there was a fellow named Wei Ning, he's called the sixth patriarch of Zen, and he's famous for this line: from the beginning, no thing is. Okay? Not nothing, which would also be true, but no thing is. And when I look at that, what it points me to is that we are constantly discriminating. We are constantly differentiating between things. Okay, there's that, and 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 there's that. So that's one process. Then we get into the world of duality. So I like that, I don't like that. That's good, that's bad. I want that, I don't want that. Okay. And in doing that process, we perpetuate the illusion of separation. So we actually are able, through doing that constantly enough, to create an imaginary world in which I'm the subject and everything else is the object. Okay? And I'm separate from life. I have to be. I'm over here and you're over there. Okay? So when we realize that that is an illusion, and most people have to kind of sneak up on that. Okay. Now, sometimes people just get it because it's sort of obvious when you think about it. There is nothing outside this reality. There isn't anything. If we just break it down to this world, it's not possible to be separate from this world. It's not. You can see that, huh?
I can.
So, just intellectually, we get, now of course I can't be separate, because, you know, if you do that little exercise where you begin to just kind of float up into space, there's just this clot of dirt, as I referred to it once, and offended this guy so hideously. I mean, he was just enraged that I would call something as beautiful as this earth a clot of dirt. Which
as though clot of dirt is a bad thing.
Pardon me?
As though clot of dirt is a bad thing. As though clod of dirt is a bad thing?
Yeah. Exactly. Exactly. Thank you. I didn't point that out to him. I was just so stunned that anybody could be that offended by that sentence. So, at any rate, once we catch on to the fact that we are not separate, then we begin to explore the things that cause us to believe that we're separate. Okay? So all of the things that I keep at arm's length are the things that are perpetuating my world of suffering. Now, it is true that everything that I draw in perpetuates my world of suffering too, because that's the way the world of duality works. But most of us don't suffer quite as obviously over the things we cling to as the things we push away. Is that true?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Especially if we're clinging to something and we have it and we like it. I mean, that's what we're all going for, right? Fill our lives with all of the things we want and then cling to them. Have them for as long as possible and then die in our sleep. You know, it's the dream. So everything, what did she say?
Everything is an opportunity to be with.
Yeah, everything is an opportunity to be with. So every moment of life is an opportunity to see how, in fact, we are not separate. In a conditioned reality, from the conditioned mind, every moment of life is an opportunity to see how we are separate, how we are other. Okay? So every time you embrace something in life, every time you bring it in, every time you are one with it, suffering ends. Now, a piece of that that I particularly like is the one in which you see that every moment of life shows you what you are creating life to be. Okay? Because each one of us lives in the world of our own projections. So every time we are with our own projections, every time we take that in, we accept that, we embrace that, we let that be as it is, we're free. Anytime there's resistance, anytime we're trying to push something away or stay separate from it, there's suffering. Suffering is really that separation. It's the process and the content of separation. It's the act of separation.
Okay. I'm feeling confused, so I'm going to ask for clarification.
Okay. Now, do you need me to tell you why you're confused?
No.
Okay. Good.
My experience these days is one of suffering, is one of what you just described. And I think the part of me who asked you the question is wondering how I can be with myself through what I'm living in right now that's unpleasant.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm hearing being with what's unpleasant, what I'm seeing as unpleasant is being with what I, when if I look out there and see something I don't like, if I can be with that.
Yes.
And I'm also wondering about being with me who doesn't want to be with that.
Yeah, because in this, it's funny, we're talking about duality or separation, and yet we're looking at two of you.
At least.
Yeah, so you're in a situation, whoever you are, and we don't know who that is, because there are lots of yous, right? So there's a situation, and there are parts of you who don't mind that situation at all, who aren't upset, don't have anything going about at all. So within us, we can have one event and have a part of us who likes it, a part of us who is neutral about it, and a part of us who hates it. It's actually one of the primary things the Buddha taught, how helpful it is to look at those three reactions to life, that we are always finding life pleasant, unpleasant, or we're indifferent to it. We like it, we don't like it, we don't care, we don't even notice it. Okay? So you could probably notice those responses in yourself, but the one that you're dealing with is, there's a situation, a part of you really doesn't like it, is really unhappy over it. But within that, you're also aware that there's a part of you that isn't triggered by that situation. Okay?
That's what I would like to have more awareness of.
Uh-huh. So right now, it feels as if this situation arises and you get triggered and you're just identified with the part of you who is triggered. There's nothing else going on.
And I have to be there. I can't get out, so how do I get through it?
Okay.
That's her question.
Now, see, that's really interesting. That's another one of those traps. Okay? So if you want to keep somebody, there are several ways to keep somebody in suffering. And you just identified a big one. You create a problem that cannot be solved. And then they have to stay there. Okay?
Exactly.
And, of course, that's not true. Because there's nothing in life, except perhaps death, that a person can't walk off from. I mean, there'll be consequences, but there's consequences to everything. So conditioned mind puts us in situations and says, okay, now this is the way it is, and you have no choice. Now be happy. If you're a really spiritual person, you could be happy anyway. I just love that one. That's one of my favorite ones. If you were the right person, you could be happy in hell. And the fact that you're not happy in hell is all the proof we need that you are the wrong person. So if you are in that place, now you're not, or you wouldn't be talking to me about it, okay? A person who really is locked into a situation like that doesn't talk about it. Now, you may only have an eighth of an inch distance from it, but you do have distance from it. Okay? So the person who can identify the situation is not the one who is trapped in it. So this is the person that you want to spend more time with.
Yes. And what I notice is the person who has compassion for the one who feels she's stuck there.
Oh,
yes. And not quite knowing what to do to help take care of her.
Yeah. Well, now, again, I gave a big hint there, okay? You can let her not be there.
It's hard for me to find anyone in here who believes that would be
yes,
okay.
Yes, because that's the way conditioning sets us up, okay? So the only person who can do that job is the person who despises doing that job. How do we get these rules? Okay, so there's you couldn't be in a situation like that. So there you are. You have to what? What do you have to do that's hideous? Work. Yeah, just work. Work. Okay, so you have to work, and the person who gets sent to work hates to work. But there's somebody there saying, no, you have to go to work. Well, why doesn't the person saying you have to go to work go to work? Now, this can sound silly, but I'm telling you, it's the key to freedom. Okay? So the person says, no, you have to go to work. I hate work. I don't want to go to work. You have to go to work. It's, you know, it's like being a teenager. You know, with your parent. You have to clean up your room. I don't want to clean up my room. You have to clean up your room. Why do I have to clean up my room? That's every kid's question. It's a really valid question. Okay? I don't care about a clean room. If you want the room clean, clean it. Okay? But we grow up in a world where, no, you have to clean your room. Why? 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 Okay? Because we like your room cleaned. Because good people have clean rooms. The right people have clean rooms. And clean has a certain standard with it. Right? Are you with me on all of this?
I am with you. It's easier because it's not my content, so I'm seeing.
Yeah. Oh, that's why we brought the kid with the room, you know. Yeah. So if that were within the same person, if that weren't a young person and a parent, that's in the same person. In fact, somebody called last week, right, who likes a clean house but hates to clean.
Yeah.
And this is essentially, I mean, this is kind of what we talked about. You know, why is this person who hates cleaning house identified as the person who has to clean the house? Okay, because the person would say, because there's nobody in here who wants to. Well, that's bogus. If there were nobody in there who wanted a clean house, we wouldn't have a problem. We'd have a pigsty, but we would not have a problem. Okay, so there's somebody in you who is holding standards for how this person has to be in these circumstances. So let that person be there meeting her standards for how somebody should be in these circumstances, and let the person who doesn't want to be there go to the beach. If there's nobody there to do it, then that's the answer. But again, you know, we don't want to face the consequences. So then we just start beating somebody into doing something that they despise.
And that's helpful because I noticed there is someone who wants to do it, and the one who's beating the little one into doing it would be the worst person to do it. She's harsh and judgmental, and
yeah,
she'd
and
be the last person.
That's something that's really important for us to get. That drama of somebody beating a young person into doing something they don't want to do has nothing to do with content. Nothing. So it'll be because you have to work. Okay, that's why. Or because you need to clean the house, or because you need to, whatever it is. But that cruel relationship has nothing to do with the stated purpose for that cruel relationship. The only thing that's going on is cruelty. That's all. And it's the hardest thing for people to get. So do most people here tonight know what I'm talking about when I talk about the voice that's beating you up? Okay? The hardest thing for people to get is that nobody ever got to be a good enough person not to be beaten up by that voice. Never. Nobody ever. Ever. People who are not beaten up by that voice are people who refuse to be beaten up by that voice. That's all. It's not like they're perfect people, and so the voice went away. So separating those things out, there's whatever this circumstance is in your life that you're dealing with, and then there's the cruel person beating up on the young person.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so they get put together. Why is this beating going on? Well, because she needs to do this thing that she doesn't want to do, that she's not doing well. No. Every abusive relationship has an excuse. Everyone. I beat you because. You need to be punished because. No, you need to be punished because I need to punish somebody and you're the one I've picked. And that's it.
Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thank you.
I'd like to invite anyone else who wants to step up to the microphone and ask a question. And Sherry, I was wondering, I'm guessing there are some people here who might not be familiar with all the language you're using tonight, conditioning, identity, aspects of the personality, because you're talking about process that's going on inside our own heads. So yeah. If you could say a little more about that.
So when we're growing up, you know, it's so funny. Conditioning is such an amazing thing. We could call it brainwashing or programming or training or socialization or, you know, we could call it any number of things. But what it does is take somebody who knows nothing about how a particular situation works and create a reality for that person. So here you have a very small child, and the child knows nothing about the way life works and has to be taught everything. Not just language, but now that we're conditioned into the reality that we're conditioned into, we're socialized the way we are, it's almost impossible for us to get that's all that has happened. This reality is not real. It's just the one we were conditioned into. Okay? So sometimes if you travel to other places, you get a little tiny sense of that. But the world nowadays is not like it was 100 years ago, where you could go to places where, you know, people are doing things that you can't even recognize. You know, they're putting their neighbors in tubs and boiling them and things like that. They're actually no more bizarre than the things that we do. It's just that the things that we do seem really normal, and the things that they would do would seem really odd. And it's not okay. We can't just say, oh, that's really odd, or that's really interesting. We need to say, that's wrong. There's really something wrong with doing it that way. Because a huge part of socialization is to be the right person. Okay, whatever that is. So in this country, we have things like class, which we don't think a lot about perhaps, but by Jove, we have it. So if we have people growing up in a very poor area, and there's not a lot of education going on, and they have their way of interacting, they must conform to their culture in the same way that we are required to conform to ours. And so that, you know, then you get the working class people. And, you know, if you're, I mean, here we are, Stanford University. Yeah, I mean, this is as good as it gets, isn't it? But not if you're in a working class neighborhood in Boston. Okay? This would be viewed with absolute contempt. Do you know that? So here we are, striving so hard to be the right person so that everybody will know that we're the right person, and then we run into contempt? How is that possible? So we have to make that person wrong, okay? So that we can be okay. So my whole point of this is, little child comes along, and the little child is being molded constantly into the environment that he or she is going to live in. And, of course, that's all through the eyes of the parents. So the parents bring their unconscious conditioning, because most of us are unconscious about our conditioning. Parents bring that into the relationship. The first thing that happens for anybody who's ever been in a relationship is that the conditioning of the parents runs into each other. Right? So that's what marriage is about, or any intimate relationship, friendship, anything. You're ironing out the, you think what? Why do you do that? You eat that? How could you, why are you wearing that? Okay? Big issues, right?
Yes.
Yes, big issues. Okay, so then the parents into that well-integrated environment bring a child, and now the child is going to have to fit in. So the child comes in, whoever he or she is, and runs into no, There are statistics on this. I wish I knew what they were. But, I mean, it's astronomical, the no's that a child hears in comparison to the yeses. It's just, you know, like thousands to one. So the child is going along and is adapting in this conditioning process. So just constantly splitting off. Okay, that doesn't work. I'll be this way. Okay, that doesn't work. All right, I'll try this. All right, that's not working. They don't like that. Okay, I'll be like this. Until what age did you say, to heck with all of you? Anybody? 13, 14? Teenage? Yeah. 35? Huh? Some of us are just sneaking up on it, huh? God, I think I'll rebel. Yeah. So, conditioning is happening. Now, remember, we were talking about the world of duality, right? So
yes.
Conditioning is going along, but we're getting conditioned on both sides of the duality, right? So they want me to be this way, but I'm not going to be this way. I'm going to be that way. So that's a value for them, so I'm going to value this. Okay? They like that. I don't. They eat healthy foods. I'm going to eat junk food. Or they eat junk food. I'm going to be healthy. You see, it can go in any direction. So we are constantly, as this conditioning process is going on, we are splitting off into these different aspects of the personality. And as we go along, this internal conversation about adapting and surviving and how to be the right person, whatever that is, because the right person could be having the most number of body parts pierced. Okay, it's not necessarily what mom or dad thought, you know, in fact, rarely is about that. So aspects of the personality are forming, and they are in this internal conversation because they're all in there, and they all have different points of view.
Mm-hmm.
Was there other jargon that I didn't cover?
Let's see, you've covered a lot of it. So one example that I like for aspects of the personality is looking in our closets and seeing what shoes we wear.
Yes.
So this is the personality when I go to work. This is my personality when I'm exercising.
Yes.
Or the clothes that we put on.
Yes. And you just don't want to make a mistake.
Right.
Yeah. It's what makes... If you could come out and look in my car right now, it's scary. Even to me, the number of sub-personalities who coexist inside that relatively small automobile.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Wow.
Mm-hmm.
And perhaps we'll have more questions clarifying the terminology also?
We could. Let's see.
Let's see. And I think we have a question over here.
The pressure's on, huh? So I wanted to, I'm totally nervous, and that's what I wanted to look at. That it's fascinating to me that, I spend some time being up in front of people doing things. And a lot of the time, I just get up there and do whatever. And I don't feel the least bit nervous or et cetera, et cetera. And yet, sitting in my seat, I really wanted to participate. I really wanted to get up and talk. And I can't get out of my seat. I mean, it was totally being controlled by the, you know, that, when Sherry was talking about projection, I was thinking, I mean, I'm controlled by what I project will happen. And what people will think of me, and you know what will happen afterwards. So it's much easier to just sit in my seat and not face it and not participate in the world.
Well, sort of, right?
Right.
Because if you had stayed there and you hadn't participated, what would it have been like as time went on?
Yeah, and that's what I was seeing actually. That when you were talking about that beating, there's an illusion that helps to keep me controlled. That by sitting in my seat, I'm avoiding that beating, and yet I'm not.
No,
I'm
you don't get the beating on this side
right.
of the duality. You get the beating on the other side.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And sometimes you can get the beating just straight through, right? So you're getting a beating because you're sitting there and you're nervous.
Right.
And then the implication is if you stand up and talk, then you won't get a beating. You stand up and talk, you sit down, and the beating starts because why did you stand up and open your mouth and
exactly.
now everybody knows you're an idiot and why
exactly.
did you say that?
Yeah. Yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah. And the thing about that, see if this is true for you. You're sitting there in your seat and you don't even have to have a lot of thoughts or voices about that. Just your nervousness means all of these things. So the, you know, the heart is kind of, and the adrenaline is going, and that means you're going to feel foolish. You're afraid.
Right.
If you get up there, you're going to be nervous.
Uh-huh.
It's going to be uncomfortable. You're not going to like it. You know, the conversation has happened for so many times
right. That,
and that's true across the board with just about everything in life. You know, we rarely have to listen to the conversation in order to get information. It's just
mm-hmm.
there.
Mm-hmm.
Feel the sensation in your body. You know what it means, and
mm-hmm.
you're off and running.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I get in opposition with that, you know, all those sensations in my body. So as you said, it means all these things. And then there's a sense of, you know, why, okay, I got to stop. How can I stop this? How can I get to that way when I could get up and just not feel self-conscious? How can I get to that place? How can I?
So that's kind of the same question, isn't it? How do I be with the one
right.
who is having this experience?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And of course, that's the place where we start talking about the unconditional.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because we have to get to the place with ourselves where it doesn't matter
yeah.
what happens.
Yes. Yeah.
So I get stand up there and make a total fool of myself.
Yeah.
Good.
Right.
You know, it doesn't mean I'm not lovable. It
yeah.
doesn't mean I'm not a good person.
Yeah.
It doesn't. In fact, what we begin to get to is the only place where I could make a fool of myself is if I listen and believe those
right.
voices in my head that want me to have that opinion of myself.
Right.
Because it doesn't exist anywhere else.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a sense, you know, sitting there, it's like there's this little person who just wants to, you know, participate,
yeah.
just participate. And what it requires is someone, exactly as you're saying, just someone to be there and say, great, participate.
Jump on up.
I'm here no matter what. I
yeah.
don't care how, it, you know, what happens and how you sound and, you know, whatever comes out of it. It's totally fine. You know, just that, as you're saying, it's the unconditional. That then it just opens everything up to, you know, life suddenly becomes whatever it is. No, you know, dropping the standards and just playing.
Yes. Yeah. My new favorite expression. Well done. Played hard.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Yeah. That's all it is. You played hard. Well, did you win? Yeah. Of course. I played hard.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Who cares what the scoreboard said?
Right. Yeah. And in that conditioned system, like you were talking about before, it's all about, did I meet the standard? Was I the right person? Which, as you point out, is so crazy, because what is the standard? It's always changing. We can't ever meet it. So what's the point?
Yeah. To get it that there is a voice inside your head that wants you to feel bad.
Mm-hmm.
So everybody, you know, you can play the game right here tonight. You know, just jump up there behind the microphone and say something. And watch what happens.
Mm-hmm.
That voice wants you to feel bad.
Right.
It's going to tell you everything that was wrong with what you said. It's going to point out that you have no idea what you said. Because you got up there, you left your body because you were terrified, and then your mouth was moving along, and
right.
did you make sense? Did you finish sentences? You know, who knows?
Yeah.
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 And the better you do, the more wound up it gets.
Right.
You know, better meaning
mm-hmm.
the more you were there.
Right. Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Good. Thank you.
Sure, it's amazing how that voice controls everything we do. And I was thinking about, you know, when we bring the willingness to whatever it is that we're doing, you know, there's a sense that voice loses some of its grip.
Absolutely, it does.
Yeah.
It only has the power we give it.
Mm-hmm.
That's all. If we yeah. never believed another word it says, we would be absolutely free.
Yeah.
And would we then go out and make fools of ourselves? Would we make bad decisions? Would we, no more so than we do now?
Right. Absolutely.
And yeah. we'd be a lot happier because we wouldn't have somebody talking to us about it all the
yeah.
time.
Yeah. So we go out, we do what we do, see what we get.
That's what we
if
did.
If there's not a lot of yammer, 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 then there's less fear of going out and trying something
when
new.
We're 3 years old, we just want to play. We just want to participate. That's
Absolutely.
All. And the doing it is everything.
Yeah.
We're not doing it for a result. We're doing it for the sheer fun and pleasure of doing it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I think we have another question.
So I was very excited when you said, just get up and get in front of the microphone, because I too was sitting there thinking, oh, I want to say something. I want to ask a question. But I noticed that this voice kept saying, well, what exactly are you going to ask? And how would it, blah, 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 and all of that stuff. And so when you said, well, just get up, I just got up. And so it's really scary just to get up here. But I wanted to talk about money when you were saying about the really real stuff. And I don't know exactly what, but there's some process that I'm doing that is causing a lot of suffering, and it has for a really long time. And I just thought it'd be interesting just to come up and just not know what I was going to say.
Uh-huh. But it's something about money.
But it's about money.
Uh-huh.
And it's about, I know, because it started coming up for me when you were talking about one person saying, go do this, and they're saying it to someone else. And I sort of had this inkling that there's someone saying, you need to make more money, and that they're saying it to someone who's about 5 years old.
Yes.
And so this person's saying, huh? Oh, well, okay. And they're off and they're playing and they're doing, you know, whatever games they have, but they're not really making money. And so the other person's yelling.
Because they don't know how.
They don't know how.
Yeah.
And frankly, they don't care.
Yes. Yeah. And so we have to wonder what kind of a system this is that would set that up, that would put a very small child. Now, does this make sense to people when you listen? Do you often feel that way? Or do you ever feel that way, that a small child has gone out in the world to do something that a grown-up really ought to be doing? Okay? I swear to you, at least based on the number of people that I talk to, three-year-olds are running this country. Okay? Three-year-olds go to work every day and are out there trying to make things happen and feeling very stressful and unhappy and unfulfilled, and as they would. Okay? Yeah. So what alternative do you see in that? If you're not going to let a five-year-old be in charge of this, who might be in charge of it?
I think maybe right there is the problem. Like, you know, there's no one stepping up to the plate who's saying, oh yeah, I'll do that, or oh, I know how to do that. Maybe I think there might be people who are very willing, but they're certainly not going to step up to the plate because maybe they don't know how, and they know, you know, what a terror this other person is, you know, who's cracking the whip.
Which is, again, that's the whole deal, isn't it? It's just the setup is for the abuse, for the
right.
Mistreatment, which doesn't make any sense until you consider that unhappiness, that dissatisfaction, that beating that's going on is the thing that keeps us at the center of the world, and it's familiar, and it's how we survived childhood. Which again tells me that this world is full of small children just replicating their childhood, surviving day after day after day. So my life doesn't really work. I don't really have what I want. My relationships aren't fulfilling. I don't feel successful. This isn't the person that I should be. But, you know, I can punish myself in these ways. I can indulge whatever this is and then feel bad about it. I can stay in this very young drama. And that's what most people do instead of living their lives, is just keep acting out this very young drama.
Yeah, and I can see, like, when you're talking, how it just gets perpetuated so unconsciously, because the whole time you're talking, this voice is saying, you know, well, money is really important, and you do need to earn it, and this is the reason why, and, you know, what's she talking about? There's just this whole running dialogue going on.
Yes, yes. And, of course, we begin to confront that when we realize that dialogue is not resulting in money.
Right.
In fact, that conversation is what's keeping me from being able to make money. I drove down from the mountains today, And I was listening to something on the radio, and this woman was at the, I don't know whether, maybe, let's say the Toronto Film Festival, and she saw this movie that she just loved. And I can't remember, it'll come to me, what the name of it was, but it's a Greek film. She said she saw it at 9 o'clock in the morning, and at 9 o'clock, who wants to watch a movie at 9 o'clock in the morning, you know? And 30 seconds into it, she was completely captivated. Well, it was picked up by whomever and showed twice in the United States. And she decided that everybody needed to see this movie. She just got passionate about it. And she actually has started a distributing company just to distribute this movie. She spent thousands of her own dollars making this happen. Now, today she was on NPR being interviewed about this movie. Now, what do you think is going to happen? Okay? Tons of people are going to send her money. I'll probably be one of them. Okay? And people want to see this movie. Right? Now, my whole point about this is, and the reason that I would send her the money, is that I just love it when people are passionate about anything. Hmm. Anything. I don't care what it is. Just to be passionate. To me, that's worthy of being rewarded. And if she were in a conversation about, well, you know, movies are controlled by big business, and everybody should see this, but it's never going to work, it's never going to happen, boy, I wish somebody would do something about this, you know, it's, ain't it awful, it's really wrong, it shouldn't be, but instead she said, everybody needs to see this movie, and I'm willing to do whatever it takes to make sure that that happens. And the interviewer said, so are you willing to spend your last dime on this? She said, well, I'm not willing to be bankrupt, but yeah. And there it is. I mean, that's, to me, that's, those are the two choices we have. Now, of course, there, you know, there are places along that continuum, but essentially that's, those are the two choices. We can either be over here in this conversation about how I need to make money and I'm not making money and this isn't working and I don't know how to make it work, or we can just throw ourselves wholeheartedly into whatever it is, and sooner or later, we will hit upon the thing. Now, people will say, but I've thrown myself wholeheartedly into stuff, and it didn't work. Well, you didn't. Okay? Because if you did, out the other end, you wouldn't be having that conversation about how it didn't work. You see, because if you play, it's a little bit ago I said, you know, did you win? Yeah, I won. You know, I played as hard as I could play. There is no conversation about results when we play as hard as we can play. And what happens to us in the process, and the thing that actually resolves concrete, material kinds of issues is that wholehearted passion. That's the thing that transforms us. And as that transformation takes place, everything works. It just does. You know, it's one of those things where, you know, smarter people than me have tried to explain why that is the case. It's just the way it works.
So can I ask you one more question?
Anything you like.
So what I saw just happen was the person who does have all the passion sort of came running up to the forefront and wanted to ask, but you know, how do I get rid of this other person so that I can actually just do what I want to do?
And you see, that's where the transformation is. Because as long as we spend our lives giving our life force to, it's not going to work, it won't work. When we are so devoted to whatever it is. And, you know, we can be devoted to life force. There doesn't need to be any content to it at all. Do you know what I mean? You can be passionate about passion. You don't have to be passionate about something. When we are so passionate about whatever it is that we're doing, that it doesn't matter what anybody else is doing, we're free. But if it's, you know, years ago there was that expression about don't let the turkeys get you down, and somebody sent me a, do you remember that? Somebody sent me this card with this, you know, this person, and the, just turkeys all over them, you know. And I kept it for a while because I thought it was such a good visual image of that experience of being weighed down by all of the things that don't fly. Yeah, so when it doesn't matter, you know, every genius, everybody that we know as a genius, I think would tell the same story. They just couldn't help themselves. So the person who had to paint just had to paint. That's all. You know, what if nobody ever buys it? What? Buys it? What? I'm not painting it so somebody will buy it. I'm painting it because I have to paint it. It doesn't matter if nobody even ever likes it. I have to get it from here to here. And that's what we're doing. To me, that's what we're doing all the time. We're taking that life force, that what I call conscious, compassionate awareness. We're experiencing it inside ourselves, and our lives are a process of making that real and visible in the world. So when I talk about life living itself, life living you, well, life wants you to have, as far as I can tell, life wants you to have everything. There's no telling what that'll look like. There's no telling how long that'll last. So, we don't want to get casual about this. But life wants you to have everything. And in the moment that we are truly present and not engaged in that conversation with what won't work, we feel it. Do you remember that movie, Chariots of Fire? And that line when the guy said, when I run, I feel God's pleasure. Now, is he projecting? Of course he is. But that's as good a way to talk about it as any I've ever heard.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Wow. Time is flying by here.
Is it?
Yes, it is.
Is it? Where's Jan? Is it? And for people who have been, is that just Zimbabwe? South Africa too? I didn't hear it in South Africa, but when we were in Zimbabwe, people would, it just like that. Time is flying by, only that was illogical. So if Michael had said, you know, it's really started to rain, and I would say, is it? It's the cutest thing, is it? And they, you know, it's one of those things where I think you have to be born there to really be able to get it right. So it's like African-American women can say, uh-huh. And if you're not African-American, I mean, I practice that all the time. I can't do it. Okay. Is it? Okay.
It is 6 p.m.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, shall we take a break?
We're going to take a quick break. We're going to have some wonderful piano music here in the lounge.
Where is the piano? Oh, there it is. Oh.
Composed by and performed by the Toyon resident fellow and Stanford music professor Giancarlo Aquilanti. And he'll be playing selections from his album, Piccoli Pezzi. Perfectly pronounced, too.
Lovely. You know, you sounded like that voice on my Italian tapes.
Yes.
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 All right. And so what time shall we be back?
We'll be back here in 10 minutes with more of Open Air with Sherry Huber from Toyon Hall on the Stanford University campus.
Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome back. You're listening to Open Air with Sherry Huber. I'm your host, Michael Gray. Today we're broadcasting live from the Stanford University campus, Toyon Hall. Welcome back, Sherry.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
It's great to be here. We've been talking about everything under the sun.
Lots of stuff.
Yes. And we have another question in the audience.
Wonderful.
Hearing all these different people's stories and also sort of my own stories in my head, I'm trying to grapple with two things that I think I'm seeing, which is on the one hand, I think you're saying, it seems to be saying accepting things as it is, and then on the other hand is sort of a just do it attitude kind of approach, or these are two dichotomies that I'm forming in my head, and I'm trying to grapple that and understand what that means, and any responses you can have to sort of at least enlighten the problematic I have.
Okay, so we start there and then
yeah, we can start there.
Apply it to a concrete content.
Yeah.
Okay. For me, now, in practice, in awareness practices, I do it. The whole point is ending suffering. So that's what the Buddha taught. Mm-hmm. Life is suffering. Mm-hmm. There's a reason that we suffer. It's possible to end suffering, and there's a way to do that. And people get very confused about that. You know, I one of my favorite expressions is that suffering is optional, and I've had Buddhists say to me, "How can you say that? That's not what the Buddha taught." And I said, "Well, what is the third noble truth then? If there's a way to end it, isn't that what he actually taught?" Certainly he didn't, you know, for 2,500 years, people have not been following what he taught because he said life is suffering. But even as Buddhists, people get hung up in that. And, well, life is suffering. But it's possible for us to end suffering. Now, if ending suffering is the most important thing to us, then we will do anything to end suffering. And in my experience, the thing we cannot do is be cautious. Okay, so we have a t-shirt that says, "I don't want to tiptoe through life just to arrive safely at death."
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so my way of talking about it is, when you fall on your face, be going just as fast as you can go. Because then there'll be no mystery. Okay, you will know what happened. But, you know, if we're like this through life and we're being careful and we're being cautious and we, you know, and I'm not really suffering that much and, gosh, I'm not that alive either. Okay, so I'm not trying to be right. I'm not trying to be good. I'm not trying to, I want to be free. So I want to face everything that is keeping me from being free.
Mm-hmm.
And I personally trust life. I don't have a belief about life that life wants anything for us other than good. I actually don't have an experience of life as anything other than good. And it's not a good that has a bad as an opposite. We only have the language we have, right? So when people want to talk about something transcendent, then they put a capital letter. So this would be good.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, with a capital G. And then if you really want it to be transcendent, then you make all the letters capital. Okay, and this is how we try to indicate that we're not talking about the little G-O-O-D as compared to the little B-A-D. This is bigger. Okay? So in my experience, there is nothing other than that goodness. Life doesn't want me to suffer. It doesn't want, I'm not punished. I don't, all of that childhood stuff that we get as we're conditioned growing up. It's just not my experience of life. So I'm causing myself to suffer. I'm the one that is bringing the suffering to my life. Anything in my life is just what it is. Okay? So if I weren't conditioned to believe things should be a certain way and not another way, if I didn't have an idea that if I did things in a particular way, I could have control over life, if I got it that life is just what life is, and it's not personal, and it's not punishing, and it's not, okay, then whatever happens, I get a chance to see how I turn that, because of my conditioning, into something wrong. Okay, into something that I don't like, into something that I'm suffering over. There's nothing in life that is inherently anything. We put all of the meaning onto it. So as I'm going along in life, I get a chance to see where I hold myself back, what I believe about how I should be, what's the right way, what's the wrong way, what's the good thing, when am I, you know, if I do that, if I make a mistake, does it mean this? Does it mean, could I mess up my life? Do I believe that on some level, that I could make a bad decision and then mess up my life? Well, I might as well just go out there and go at it full tilt. And then I run into all of the things that places, ways that I cause myself to suffer, so that I can apply that awareness to it, break it down into its component parts, and move beyond them.
Yeah, I think it's still hard for me to juggle. I think seeing the difference, not the difference actually, the difference is very clear to me in a way. Sort of, it sounds like it's, just accept